Everybody's talking at me. I don't hear words they're saying, only the echoes of my mind. People stop and stare.
Hello there. Welcome to the Heritage Radio Network Farm Report, Friday, September 11th. I'm Lorenzo Reginieri. This is my co-host, Heather Hyman.
And we're here with special guest Matt Lorenz today of Trees Not Trash. We'd like to give a special shout out to our sponsor today, Paradise Locker Meats, who help butcher for small independent family farms across the country. And we thank them for sponsoring today's episode, as well as our engineer in the back there, Nat Wiener.
Matt is a graduate of the NYU Tisch School, and he works with Trees Not Trash, which is a nonprofit that starts and manages community gardens. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks for joining us on the Farm Report today.
The pleasure is all mine.
So we're going to touch on a lot of topics, including your work with Trees Not Trash. We're going to do a little DIY on making your roof more green, on improving your stormwater collection and management.
Mm-hmm. Which is perfect for today, considering we've got about 3 days of stormy rainwater coming our way here in Bushwick.
It finally got here, right?
Finally. Mm-hmm. You've been waiting.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm sure a lot of our listeners, I didn't really know what Trees Not Trash was before today, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners don't really know. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what Trees Not Trash gets done?
Sure. TNT is a Bushwick-based collective of gardeners, kind of with the emphasis being community gardens, urban greenification, that sort of thing. It's been around since, my involvement has been the last 3 years or so, but I think Kate, the founder, put it together a year or two before my involvement, before I moved here. We're on the road to becoming a full-scale nonprofit. That's what we had kind of in our winter off season when we're doing less working in the gardens. We actually were hunkering down once a month, and we've got a lawyer that's getting us squared away with our whole pro bono, like getting us all nonprofited, so to speak. But what we do is we look for and we manage community gardens that are not truly public gardens in the sense that they're open all the time. There are gardens that have certain set hours where anybody's welcome to come in to check out what's going on, to help out if they're so inclined, or just to learn about what you could be doing with a big vacant lot, of which there are quite a few in this fine region of Bushwick, Brooklyn.
And does it extend past Bushwick to the other boroughs?
It sure does. We sometimes we'll head up to the Bronx. We have a really interesting relation with a number of like nurseries, with Parks and Rec, actually. Every now and then we'll go up to the Bronx to select a number of trees that they will essentially donate to us for our purposes, which works out great for them. This group of characters down in Bushwick decide they want to put in a couple of new trees or add a couple of new shrubs to a community garden. It's essentially the sort of work that they're doing that they're getting paid to do, but they don't have to actually do anything. So all they do is we drive my truck up there, we fill it up with foliage, we bring it down, and then we distribute them. So we're, that's true. We actually work with Citizens, which is, I believe, based in Manhattan, but they have things that's all in the five boroughs. We just started an alliance with the Bushwick, one of the Bushwick branches of the public library in Brooklyn, which we're really excited about. We already have a bunch of stuff in the ground over there, and we're working on a young gardeners program to get the kids in the area excited about the idea that, hey, you can make that yourself, or you can increase the amount of green stuff in your neighborhood, and it helps everybody out. So it's really
Are
awesome.
Are schools next on the list after the library?
We're trying to prototype a project. We just got, I don't know enough about it yet, but Kate just mentioned that we have an alliance that could work out really favorably for everybody with one of the, I believe, middle schools or high schools. It might even be up to ninth graders, where their instructor wants to take them 1 or 2 days a week to the community gardens, and perhaps even to initiate a little gardening project, either in one of the schools or, you know, some nearby area.
Yeah, so it would cost them less money to do it in their own backyard probably than take a field trip to a community garden.
Right. Yeah, but I'm actually not even sure where they're at. So if they're local, it would be easy for them. And then, you know, we'd even roll out there. And, you know, we'd sometimes do little DIY, like seed bomb demonstrations where we show people how to make seed bombs, which are, I guess I shouldn't be mentioning that in a day like today. But basically, it's a clay ball that has wild seeds inside of it. that is resistant to water until it rains really hard, which is enough to saturate the rest of the soil. So you look at a big field or you look at some sort of region that nobody can really get to, but it'd be nice to see a couple of colorful flowers in there. You just carry some in your back pocket and throw them over the fence, and then when it rains...
Tree growers.
There you go. Well, I'm not sure about trees, but certainly little tufts of wildflowers. I mean, trees would be considerably harder because they need to germinate generally, but I'm sure the tree bomb is probably the next project.
Okay, fine. Well, that's cool. That's definitely very interesting and different from anything I've heard before.
It's fun stuff.
So I understand your expertise spills over into other areas of urban greening. Mm-hmm. I understand you're an expert in stormwater collection. Mm-hmm. So explain to us what role collecting stormwater plays in the footprint of a city, and what measures cities have to take to reduce their impact on overall global warming by making their stormwater collection more efficient, and what individuals can do, you know, not to necessarily execute a full green roof, but how they can make a small difference in the overall impact.
Well, I guess the easiest example for me to talk about would be just to talk about the little green roof prototype that I have on my own building just right up the street. It's only about 25 foot by 25 foot. Just the standard, you know, Brooklyn rooftop with just a bunch of black tar, nothing particularly distinguishing about it. It gets hot in the summer. In the winter, there's snow on it. There might be, you know, a bottle or two out there left over from barbecue, but that's pretty much it. I think anybody that lives in the city probably either sees these out of their window or can approach them pretty easily from their own place. On our building, over the last 3 years or so, I've gradually started to, I guess I won't call it a green roof per se. A green roof, according to the kind of technical definition, is where you literally have the roofing membranes inspected for their load-bearing capacity. You have a root barrier put in. You have a growing medium brought in. It's a very extensive or intensive project that can cost a lot of money. Its long-term benefits are amazing in terms of keeping it cooler during the summertime, warmer in the wintertime, stormwater management, which I'll get to in a second. But if you don't have the resources,
more energy efficient,
as well as the main thing is kind of keeping urban heat blight, which is, or I think it's called urban heat island blight or something. I think I'm re-scrambling that term a little bit, but it's essentially the phenomenon that surrounds larger cities where, in the absence of trees and pastures and meadows and so forth, you have concrete and steel and tar. They're generally of a darker color. A lot of emphasis these days is being put on making a white roof, which is a transition towards a green roof. It's simply just painting it white.
Like in Greece.
Yeah, exactly. Well, if you look at exactly a lot of hot Mediterranean areas, it's all white. Just reflect it out. You do not want to be in a dark colored place when you're dealing with 100 plus degree temperatures. So a white roof is kind of a transition towards a green roof. But on our roof, it's not really a green roof as much as it is just a whole mess of handmade, generally from recycled materials, planter boxes that I built myself or that I've helped to build. We sometimes have workshops how to build these things with Trees Not Trash. We go up to, we get a lot of wood donated from a place that I should plug called Build It Green up in Astoria, which is in Queens. Amazing place to buy like extra stuff. They'll earmark wood for us. We get it donated to Trees Not Trash. We build planter boxes and then we put them in places where you can't actually get something in the ground. Or even if you could get something in the ground, you might not want to have it in the ground because we do live in an area where there's a lot of nasty stuff.
Right. So you want to put your own soil in that planter box.
Put your own soil that you know where it came from, and especially if you're growing stuff that you're going to eat.
Yeah.
But anyway, the idea of managing stormwater occurred to me when I looked at the side of my building. So to lay it out for you, there's our like 25 by 25 roof deck that's essentially the garage roof. Then there's another two in the second and third floor. And then on top of that, there's a 40 by 25 foot essentially just the top part of the roof with the parapet wall, silverized paint, the whole thing. A big 4-inch downspout, which is just the conduit for the water during a storm, goes down and then it would just spill right onto our secondary roof. At some point a couple of years ago, I had seen it done elsewhere and I was like, wow, wouldn't it be a great idea to redirect that 4-inch downspout into first one big basin, and then later, you know, as it is now, there's a network of four basins. You've seen that trick where there's a bunch of wine glasses and you pour in the top one and it dripples in the next one.
Yeah, like
the
they have at weddings.
Exactly.
Or champagne.
We've got a version of that going right outside the building. So essentially, the first main reservoir will fill up, which is, I believe, a 50-gallon drum. Okay. And then I have two little plumbing. I do a lot of little DIY plumbing projects. So there's two little necks that are 90-degree necks that will distribute the water to the next one, then it'll go into the next one. So essentially, a good 20-minute downpour, the likes of which pretty much June was characterized by here in Brooklyn, mm-hmm. we could fill that. It would fill up to the top in maybe 20 minutes. So, for example, last night, pretty much a light rain. We were bone dry yesterday. Now mm-hmm. I've got about 200 gallons worth of water. So that allows you to water all your whole garden without ever having to draw an energy bill, or mm-hmm. I'm sorry, a Department of Environmental Protection bill, which is essentially the water issuing authority. So the idea that we don't have to ever use a hose mm-hmm. to water all of the stuff that I have on there. And my whole roof is, anybody that's been there, we call it the Garden of Breeden. There's a lot of there's a lot of stuff going on there. We have sugar maple. We have Japanese wisteria. There's strawberries, a lemon tree. Plums, just you name it.
And we need to get you in touch with our activist for pawpaws, Neil Peterson, and see if we can get you a pawpaw tree going on in Brooklyn.
Sounds pretty good.
That would be awesome.
Totally. But anyway, so the idea that you've got this water, what happens to it when it rains? Okay, it goes into the sewers, washes through the streets. It might give the streets a bath or two, which seems great. But what happens is any water that can't get absorbed into the sewer system is admissibly dumped into the rivers. Mm-hmm. Of course, living on the end of Long Island, all that water goes right into the East River or maybe in the Hudson on the other side and then flows right down past the beaches that we enjoy during the summer. Mm-hmm. So the idea that when there's a heavy rainfall and you're swimming in the ocean a couple of days after that, you're probably dealing with higher than normal amounts of nasty stuff. Wow. This can be disease-causing bacteria. This can be would you want to take a bath in the water that's going down the street? Well, essentially, you're doing that when you go after the water has reached a certain saturation point.
So when we go out to the Rockaways or something.
Yeah, it does make you reconsider the Coney Island experience. Yeah, ooh. Well, for other reasons.
Yeah.
But so the idea that instead of having that all the roofs discharging all their water right into the sewers and then right into the rivers at one time, the idea of managing your stormwater is keeping it reservoired in one or more receptacles. The mm-hmm. easiest way to do it is a big old trash can, maybe a big trash can to a couple of paint buckets, whatever. Then that water, the first benefit is that you get to use it to water all your wonderful greenery you have on your roof. The second benefit is that instead of releasing all that water at one time, it's slowly discharging it first through the plants, and then it might end up making it back in. But if it's getting discharged over the period when it's not intense rain, mm-hmm. it's much less likely to wind up in the water table or eventually in the streets,
or in the beaches and all of that.
Exactly.
Awesome.
So that's kind of the main emphasis behind trying to do. And other than me just being lazy and not wanting to take a 5-gallon bucket and walk between my shower and out the window, you know, 5 times a day, because totally. It takes a lot of water out there in the garden.
Yeah, and it's heavy.
It sure is. It is.
So what's greenwalling? Is this a similar, like, what is greenwalling?
Greenwalling is a term applied to the use of growing things vertically along a wall, or at least part of a wall, for the same reasons that somebody might do a green roof, mm-hmm. In order to keep the rays of sun from going directly onto your roofing membrane or your wall membrane. You're having them strike the photosynthetic cells in the leaf. Mm-hmm. It looks prettier. When it blows, the wind kind of goes there, birds jump into it, you know, and hang out. And you can see, you know, if you encourage them to go up the bars of your window, well, you're looking out essentially through like a nice little green mask, as opposed to whatever sort of view you have, which may or may not be pretty in this particular part of the world.
So we'd be familiar with like the IV.
Sure. IV is a real common one. And it does look really, really beautiful when it's fully, like, it's just totally, and a building's utterly bedecked with mm-hmm. With that sort of stuff. But the problem is that there's different types of climbing mechanisms that these plants will use. Uh-huh. You have, there are kind of non-invasive, and then there's more invasive species. I'm definitely not an expert on what are the different types, but for example, the Virginia creeper is commonly known to be a non-root invasive that can go up a brick wall. Okay. By using little footprints, kind of like a gecko's feet, to get in and get a purchase so that it's getting higher and higher, but it's not actually trying to exploit cracks in the mortar courses and going in and screwing up the long-term, you know, potential for your brick wall.
Wow.
So, for example, there are types of ivies that, in addition to getting their water from their base of root, which might be 20 foot down, mm-hmm. in order to pass the savings along, they'll attempt to find and exploit little niches and little cracks in the actual wall to try to get water.
Kind of like spider veins or something. Sure. Coming out. Precisely. Of like a big root.
Well, imagine, you know, a jungle tree that's just, you know, it's the higher and higher it gets, the longer it has to transport water all the way down. Mm-hmm. It would be a great savings in its energetic output to just squeeze little fingers into whatever tree it's growing on and pull water out that way. So you really have to be careful what is climbing in your building.
Infrastructure-wise. I mean, you see roots coming up all the time where in the sidewalk you have a split sidewalk because, you know, that oak tree got too big.
Trees and things that are growing are just slowly wrecking anything that's getting between them and their water or light source.
Yeah.
And in the case of, like, for example, wisteria, beautiful climbing plant. It's commonly trellised above like a little, like a garden, like an area to have like a tea in the morning. If those things actually get up onto a telephone wire where they can't be cut or where it's illegal for you to go up, they will grow into like an elephant-sized thing that just eventually will just probably just collapse the freaking... I mean, I've actually cut them down where it took me about 3 hours to cut a wisteria off of a telephone pole. And when I finally climbed down, I just fell into about a 5-foot deep pile of just cut wisteria because it just was so out of control and it was essentially choking the tree.
Did it cushion your fall?
It did. I actually saw it down there and I did like the little like nesty plunge, like fell back into it. It was quite nice.
So is improving the energy efficiency of a building the main reason why someone would put a green wall on it?
It's one of the reasons. If in combination with a green roof, you know, a green roof, of course, like I said, mentioned earlier, it's pretty cost and resource intensive to get it done. A green wall, in the sense that you're seeing them now, where there's actually little fern indentions and growing medium that's put vertically, that's a possibility. But in the case of what we're trying to do in my building, we're just literally trying to get as much green coverage climbing up the side through trellises and through little pieces of wire strung here and there. So it's not actually living in the sense that you would have little parts that are elevated at 10 feet and they need to be watered or so forth. It's literally all starting from planters, but they're going up. But you mentioned it correctly. You will have less direct sunlight beating down the side of your building. Maybe the wind that's hitting it and whisking away whatever warm molecules are there during the winter. I mean, there are some, for example, we use one of my favorites for growing that I would recommend is a Japanese honeysuckle that retains its green foliage all year. It never dies back, stays green. It doesn't grow during the winter. But as soon as the spring starts, it does its next little wave of growths and it's a beautiful thing to put right on the actual metal, bars, like the security bars in your window. Cause again, it'll just furl up through those. You're looking out of your kitchen at this nice little green sort of thing. And, every now and then a little bird will come and like kick back in there and like wonder whether the jungle extends inside the house as an edge.
So New York lays pretty much in the middle between the cities that have taken the most advancements towards greening their landscapes and the cities to which the movement still hasn't really arrived.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the examples of other cities where urban greening has really like reached its apotheosis, and some of the cities where some of the continents where this kind of thinking still hasn't even been exported to?
I think Chicago keeps coming up as the most in the United States as far as the green roof kind of movement. Chicago keeps coming up as a really strategically, like, progressively thinking city where they're really, I mean, their entire city hall, if you look at pictures of it, it's like a massive like city block sized area where this beautiful intensive green roof that you can walk up on and, you know, take a coffee break up on. It's beautiful. The United States, however, I think is probably pretty far behind another couple of countries I would mention, the Netherlands being, and Germany being two.
They're the best at everything.
They're pretty, well, they have a technologically advanced infrastructure. They have, in the case of the Dutch, I mean, the Dutch, no Dutch person lives above about, you know, 2 meters above the sea.
Mm-hmm.
So global
quality
warming
of life is so much better.
Global warming affects them in a way that it can be ignored perhaps elsewhere. You've got fairly wealthy nations that are forward thinking and that are actually and you know, the idea of doing a green roof is something that's come into vogue in terms of people talking about it, which is great. It's lip service, it's creating a buzz and so forth. But I mean, you'll see green roofs in the Netherlands that have been there. I mean, they suggest just by their topography and forms. I mean, you're looking at essentially a forest that's on the top of the roof, and it's mm-hmm. been there for decades. So they're pretty much, it's always a treat to just see what sort of interesting growing membranes they've got up there on the roof. And I think they actually, there's a certain I might be totally wrong on this, but I'm pretty sure that there's some sort of governmentally imposed mandate that new structures required to have a certain percentage of coverage of greenery, or else they just don't get passed. In the Netherlands.
And that hasn't hit the United States yet.
Not yet, as far as I know. There's
things like tax incentives.
I think that's right. There's rebates. The New York City, I think last year, started a rebate program where they will subsidize a certain percentage of your green roof if you choose to have it, you know, engineered and done the right way. Mm-hmm. It ends up being a pretty big savings. But the real savings, I think, is the long term when your heating and cooling costs over, let's say, 10 or 15 years are drastically reduced because you're just keeping hot sun from beating down during the summer and warm air from getting out because it's a thicker, like a growing living medium during the winter.
So this whole movement that we're trying to try, like, you know, move forward with here in the United States, it's almost like kind of going back to our roots in the sense, like, not our roots personally, but in, like, you know, the Netherlands, for instance, they've been doing it not necessarily for the same reasons that we're now trying to promote this. They just had this happening. It was natural. And now we're just like kind of following in their footsteps, but we're kind of making it like a movement because it makes sense. Would you
sure.
say that?
And making sense as in like the pronunciation or the spelling with C-E-N-T-S. I mean, once you almost have to dangle the financial carrot in front of a lot of building owners.
Because the ethical one just doesn't come up for
some strange reason. I mean, you know, greed can run in a bunch of directions, mm-hmm. and even if that's the motivation, mm-hmm. that somebody is deciding to finally do the right thing, so to speak, mm-hmm. that's enough.
Right.
And I think I can't. I'm not going to make some sort of blanket generalization that mm-hmm. you know the Dutch have a better ethical, you know, but whatever they just I think they probably have had a certain awareness of it earlier. And that awareness probably also has to do with making money. I mean, the Dutch are famously good business people, right? I mean, so, but there must be some sort of halfway point between trying to make the best investment and trying to do the best thing.
Right.
That kind of has a nice marriage.
Somewhat. It's kind of similar to like the whole slow food movement, like bringing it mm-hmm. back to the earth. You know, mm-hmm. it sounds like with what we're doing, we're kind of just bringing it back to what traditional, you sure. know, Dutch, not necessarily settlers, but sure. builders were doing. Yep. And that's why these
making do with what you have and trying to make that last as long as possible. And that's a basic kind of utilitarian emphasis. Sure.
We're all kind of moving backwards to move forwards
every day. Sometimes you have to do that for sure.
So you mentioned briefly to me the greenest building in the world being in Denmark.
And the Netherlands.
It's in the Netherlands. Can you tell me about this building?
There's a fairly prominent, at least in Holland, architect who actually is a friend of mine's father. He has a plan that's being developed right now into full-scale fruition that's for the greenest building in the Netherlands. And that's the quote. I don't know that it would be the greenest in the world, but you could probably guesstimate that it might be, since the Netherlands is so advanced in this sort of thing.
Or at least compared to
relatively. Yeah, the building, the plans that I saw, the architect's name, by the way, is Jon Christensen, who's actually, he's Icelandic Dutch. He teaches at Delft University in the Netherlands. He and his wife have an architecture firm that's just remarkable. They do a lot of really beautiful kind of repurposing of old structures. He's developed a really remarkable technology for breathing windows, which will allow air to pass through, but not to take the temperature down or high. It's this remarkable system that he basically has patented.
He's a scientist as well.
He's I don't know if you could say scientist per se. He's definitely a scientifically oriented engineer. Right. Let's put it that way. He also was the first to turn me onto the idea of a triplet system, like a water system where there's black water, gray water, and white water, where you're essentially, the idea of black water is, I think it's now pronounced chi. Isn't that the former defense contractor? Anyway, black water is the wastewater. This is sewer. This is stuff that comes out of the toilet. This is stuff that needs to be dealt with and ferreted away somewhere. But you don't have to just flush it down the proverbial toilet and get rid of it. You can actually take measures to reconstitute it to some extent, to make it used for fertilizer, to make it essentially what's called gray water. Gray water can be used to water plants. It can be used for certain like irrigation sorts of things.
It's
non-potable. But I think in some cases, you know, if it's not really, I mean, you could probably wash your car with it. You know, it's not. Sure. You definitely don't want to take a drink of it.
Mm-hmm.
But gray water, I think, can be turned back into white water, which is of the stuff that you're, you know, drinking, the stuff that you're cooking with, stuff so forth. So
I've never heard these terms before.
Yeah, I never had either until I was looking, and he was bandying them about with such regularity to suggest that these are things that have been on his mind for decades. But I only heard about it a few years ago. So anyway, this black, white, and gray water system allows each of the buildings that are kind of these modularly attached kind of modern Dutch structures, allows them to use the breaking down of the molecular action in the black water, turning it into gray water, to use that as a source of energy. So, and then there are different stages. It's not as though you just add a pill to the black water and suddenly becomes a gray water, but there are things where you can be running it through a series of filtration systems that involve living membranes, certain plants that are able to take out certain of the bad stuff, toxins. Of course, you probably wouldn't want to have a tomato plant down there, and because for something that's literally wicking some of the bad stuff out, and what's passing through it is in a slightly higher, this can be a piecemeal sort of process that can constantly be recycling the water.
It's like a filtration system in itself.
Sure is. A living filtration
that
system.
That is really,
I mean, remarkable. He's basically has, well, among the similar movement in the Netherlands, they essentially have engineered like a kind of a natural, if I can invoke a biological explanation, like almost like a kidney, a living, like this big thing that's just taking stuff through, filtering out, and what comes
out. Would
that
be the liver?
The liver, yeah. What do the kidneys do again?
I don't know, but people give those things away all the time, so they can't be that important.
That's what God gave you too.
They have to do with blood pressure, the kidneys.
Exactly.
So it's the liver that we all like to kill sometimes.
Before our digression, your question about the greenest building in the Netherlands is this remarkable structure that I've only seen blueprints of. It's an airline hangar-sized building that is largely, it looks like it's largely sheathed with glass, which is one of the concerns where the less walls you have, the more light can pass through and then the less lights you need on during the day. But it's electrical signature. So by day, imagine the roof of this is kind of tilted in a certain angle towards the sun. So it's like a southerly facing roof.
There's a building like that in New York, right? Like the Chase building.
That new Rivington building, right? That building down on the Lower East Side, the blue one. We could try and, for all you listeners out there, we'll put an address so that you can check it out somewhere like on Google Maps or something.
Right.
But yeah, for sure.
So it's got a tilted roof.
It's got a tilted roof towards the south. This gives it maximum flat exposure towards the sun as it's making its path. But the roof itself, if I can try to describe it, it's easier for you guys because you can see my hands motioning, but it's basically like a corrugated surface that has these big troughs. The troughs are actually parabolic arches, which are taking sunlight and bouncing it to these filaments that actually are in the middle of each of the, right in the middle of each of the parabolic arches. So let's say that
it's
like a huge tanning sheet that's maybe 100 or so meters wide. And then that 100 so meters has maybe 10 or 12 actual, like,
surface area.
Yeah, it's almost like the sort of thing that if you took a skateboard up there, you could start doing some crazy stuff. But anyway, what this has a twofold purpose. The one is that it's actually generating solar energy by day, and even in a non really bright sunny day. And of course, in the Netherlands, you don't get many of those. It's similar to like the Pacific Northwest in a lot of ways, but you can still be generating heat by day, storing that energy. But the thing that's amazing about it is that at night, when the temperature changes and the surface starts to condense water, it's made of this revolutionary material. I think it's like some sort of a really highly polished metal or something. It actually, the differences in temperature, kind of like condensating on a water on a glass, water will start to form in these parabolic arches and then be collected down below, so that it essentially is generating water out of just thin air. So it's water. I read the list of all its footprints. So essentially it has zero water footprint. It has, and of course, down below it in the guts, so to speak, are these black water to gray water to white water, as well as geothermal heating and cooling, which is just another totally remarkable thing that we're not even getting close to in this country yet. It's a huge, it's a massive, well, not massive, it goes down maybe 100 or so meters into the ground, just generating and taking cold water, heating it up down there and pumping it back up. And also, it can be used to heat and cool water as well as air. So there's the air conditioning or the heating and so forth.
You need the water to make the heat or the
precisely.
Air conditioning.
And then the water can be pumped. You can take some of the gray water that you're generating and use that as the stuff that's getting pumped to the radiators, because what's going into the radiator doesn't need to be of pristine quality.
All right. So is this patented yet?
He is in the process of building it along with a consortium of firms. And I don't know when their expected finish date is, but it's probably not anytime soon. I mean, this thing was massive. And then, of course, it's going to be retail shops. It's going to be probably residential.
Wow.
Looking at the little graphics of it, it looks pretty remarkable. And I apologize, Jan, if you're listening, I apologize for getting the technical aspects of your project wrong. Well, but you get the drift.
Yeah, as long as you're allowed to be sharing this information.
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
Well, maybe we can have him on. We have an architecture show with Curtis Wayne, and it would be great if maybe we can get a call in from,
I'm sure
another
country. Love to talk about
it. We would just have to figure out the time zones.
Exactly.
I mean,
well,
because
somebody'd
have
to stay up late.
Yeah.
No, actually, now it's not that late in the Netherlands.
Yeah, what is it? 6 hours
it's
ahead?
It's plus
yeah,
seven
so
or so.
It's 10:30 at night there.
Yeah.
We can make that happen.
He's
I think
got a glass of Geneva in his hand. He's ready. I'll probably call him right now.
Awesome.
So, and can you touch briefly upon vertical farming? And can you also tie it into these gnarly new buildings? I mean, what do you think the city of 2050 is going to look like? Do you think it's going to be drastically different from how it is now?
It'll definitely be drastically different. I mean, there's, I guess, one kind of pessimistic view of 2050 where we won't need to help cities look green anymore. They're going to be kind of overtaken by jungles and weeds and so forth. But if we are still around, let's assume we are, and that our current attempts at making things more sustainable and greener and so forth, if those
eventually
continue,
have an impact,
so that not only will the ideas that we have, hopefully there'll be new technologies that will arise that will become commercially available,
and
that
will make the ones we're talking about now look obsolete.
Sure. Yeah, we'll remember having this conversation. God, do you remember when we thought that those green roofs was a great idea?
Well, that's what's so fun, that we're sitting here right now on 9/11 of 2009. And 10 years from now, 20 years from now, you're going to go onto the website, as long as the interweb is still working, which I have no doubt it will be. Mm-hmm. And you're going to see that these conversations started at this time, and look where we've gone from there. So
I hope we will be just totally amazed at how naive and how much we didn't know, because that just means we're hopefully learning a lot more every year we're alive.
I think every single day.
Yeah. But the 2050 idea is it's kind of an interesting thought experiment. So our buildings, are they going to get bigger? Has the era of the skyscraper, such as it is that not going to happen as much in the future?
Yeah, is it necessary?
Yeah, is it necessary? Whatever those are kind of separate questions. But I think that whatever sort of, it's obvious that we're going to continue to grow as cities. We're going to continue to have more people. We're also going to continue to feel the pinch of gas pricing and so forth. The idea of having there to be a substantial number of edible products being produced in the city as opposed to being imported from elsewhere makes sense in a lot of different directions.
Mm-hmm.
A, it's just fun to grow your own stuff. B, the more stuff you grow of your own stuff, the more that you can actually get the more stuff that you're growing yourself, the less you have to rely on kind of agribusiness or things being driven from upstate.
The smaller footprint left behind by consumption.
And it's just, let's face it, it's just fun to grow your own stuff. It's fun to bring kids to check out, and then to imagine, some of our young gardeners programs we do just with Trees Not Trash, we'll end up having like these kids come over and they're totally blown away to see a tomato just sitting out there that they can just pull off the vine and just eat. And it tastes better than any tomato that they had at the store. And they're like, where did that come from? Like, you're looking at
right
it.
Here.
Well, it's kind of like what Alice Waters tried to do with the peaches out in California with Frog Hollow Farm. Remember?
I don't remember hearing about that.
Well, it was an article. It was in the Times maybe like 4 years ago. I might be totally wrong, but basically she tries to change the way that the children eat. So instead of eating candy, she's like, well, I'll give you the sweetest peach you've ever tasted. And it came from, 20 miles up in Brentwood, California. And unfortunately, the kids were like, oh, wait, but it's fuzzy. So they didn't want to necessarily eat it. But then, we're moving forward from that point.
Sure.
But it's the same idea. I mean, people have to really start understanding there's more to what they're exposed to.
Right, absolutely. I mean, especially, city kids, they may or may not have an intuitive idea of where their food is coming from. I mean, even those of us that really try to know where our food is coming from probably don't know, unless we're really, really doing our homework and really, really being industrious to make sure that it's coming from our known locations.
I know. There's only so much you can trace, and
exactly.
Unless it's coming from your own backyard,
it's
sometimes hard to do that. Yep. But it's awesome that we have a call in for you, Mr. Matt Lorenz. Mm-hmm. So let's patch him in. Hello?
Hi, I have a question.
Hello. Thanks for calling.
I want to know, do you guys see a future where there's no farmland anymore? Everything is grown in urban environments because of, fuel costs or, man-made disasters or natural disasters? I mean, Are we looking at a future where 100% of our food is produced in urban or suburban areas?
Well, it's probably that's an amazing question. My guess is that there will probably be an increase in the number of urban gardening sort of apparatus, but my guess is that it'll never entirely move from the countries to the cities, because there's always, first of all, there's always going to be people living in the country.
Right. And who's building those buildings?
Right. Sure.
And then we have the same problem. How do we get the produce from the city to the country?
Yeah. You know, I mean, it might start this grassroots movement from the urban or the country people, like
that are already doing something on another scale.
Exactly.
To then do something in their own house.
Exactly. We're sick of getting all of our produce from these darn city gardens. We're going to start doing it ourselves again.
Yeah. So maybe like our sponsor today, Paradise Locker Meats, for example, will someday be growing the vegetables on top and, you know, cutting the meat downstairs.
Right. No, so to answer your question, caller, I imagine that it will increase, and you would only hope that it would increase to such an extent that we would not have to really think about having there be a big transportation cost overhead, like overlying our where we eat. But it probably will never be 100%. It probably will get to a certain plateau, and then it'll probably level off.
Now, this may be an obvious question to you, but it's something I've been thinking about, and I'm sure to an urban farmer such as yourself, it's like, how could you not know the answer to this? But rainwater over urban areas is more dense in pollution, isn't it? I mean, all the stuff that comes out of our cars goes into the condensed clouds and then comes back down in the rainwater, doesn't it? So, I mean, how does that affect the kind of produce that is grown in cities? I mean, do we want to be eating tomatoes that were hydrated with water that's got all sorts of nasty stuff in it?
That's a good point. I often look at the stuff that condenses at the bottom of my stormwater reclamation barrels.
Your garbage and cans now.
The garbage cans, exactly. I applied a fancy term to that. But I often look at the bottom of that, and there's this kind of silt that's down there. And this is, of course, dust, you know, burned up tires, chunks of carbon, so forth. It lands on the roof, and then it gets blown down there.
Oh, my goodness.
And then it just collects down there. But the thing that's interesting...
It's funny that that's landing on your roof.
It's landing on my roof. Like aerosolized little chunks of carburetors and like transmissions are going into my garden.
How many stories is your building?
It's just a 3-story building.
But still, come on.
That's crazy. Blowing around. Yeah, exactly. But so I think that stuff, certainly it's not, you wouldn't want to take a cup of it and just drink it. But there's another interesting thing that happens where after a couple of days that the water has been in these big cisterns and it starts to kind of generate a little bit of an algae sort of growth, kind of like a little bit of a greenish growth. I'm not 100% sure, and I would hate to find out to the contrary, but I'm pretty sure that that's got to be at least something in the way of a fertilizer. Maybe I'm just kind of looking through rose-colored glasses and saying, wow, this is adding some fertilizer to my water. But it is kind of a greenish sort of algae or some sort of growth that just basically is at the bottom of the barrel. So, you mix that up. And when you get down there, you're like, I'm going to give this to the plant that looks like it really needs a little shot in the arm, because maybe that could be the little bit of extra nutrients that's going
you
in there.
You don't know, because it is carbon and...
Yeah, yeah. But that's a good question. Like, I think in the cities, you know, you do have a lot more of a just an unadulteratedly more polluted environments. I mean, you know, and just talk about the earth here in Bushwick. If there's any gardeners out there that are considering, hey, I've got this, you know, a little bit of a backyard, I cleared away a bunch of wreckage and an old gutted taxi, you probably don't want to start growing edible stuff in there right away until you can get it tested.
Yeah, you want to dig up that land.
You want to dig it up, or you just build entirely. One of the main things that we've done over the last couple of years is just build big planter boxes that are raised, that have a vapor barrier between whatever sort of soil that you don't know about and the soil that you're growing. And then get the soil from a source that you know.
Yeah.
And then you can have raised beds with all that same surface area of the whole backyard. But you're taking a little bit less of a risk with your stuff.
Right. And I don't know if it's just you, but that they donate wood to, but maybe you could shout out again your guys, and I think you said Flushing or Queens that
that's right. Build It Green Astoria. It's a remarkable place. Hi, BIG guys, if you're listening. Those guys are incredible. They have a huge hangar-sized warehouse up in Astoria in Queens, I guess the extreme northwest corner of Queens. And it's just all refurbished stuff, whether it's building materials, whether it's old set design things that are no longer being used, doors, windows. virtually everything.
Would they take old picture frame moldings, you think?
I'm not sure what their how their protocol is for getting stuff. Mm-hmm. They may take I always bring stuff up there just to give them because the guys have come to parties at our house and they just are taken aback by what percentage of stuff in my building is from it's Builded Green. I mean, it is literally not just it's literally from Builded Green.
Right.
Because the prices are right, they're really awesome guys and they're doing the right thing, and these are all, you know, when somebody's replacing a high-end bathroom with a higher-end bathroom and they're just throwing everything away, true, those guys will pull up and get, and they'll extract this.
One man's trash is another man's treasure.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, people that are doing set design, they sleuth out things there. They're looking for, you know, a payphone to rent for a set, or they're looking for an old police locker or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's sweet.
I bought a rail there for a bike rack that evidently was used in a Madonna event. There was like 50 gold glittered, like 4x8 pieces of plywood that are used for a Kanye West video.
Yeah,
who knows? Like, hey, if you want a big piece of 3/4-inch plywood that costs half as much as it would at Home Depot, go up to Builded Green.
And it may have been used and danced on by some of your favorite living pop stars.
You might see some booty shaking next time, you know, next time you look at that piece of wood, it might have been used in a video.
This place is open for the public and for all of our listeners.
It sure is. It sure is. Look at
Builded
Green, New York City, I believe is the site.
Great. Well, we'll find it. We'll double check and we'll put it up on our site because that's really cool. You know, there's plenty of people trying to, you know, reproduce what you're talking mm-hmm. about here today, and we'd love to spread the good word.
Sure, and I'll give another quick plug to M Fine Lumber, which is right here.
Oh, we love them.
Oh, you guys have used them too, right?
Yeah, M Fine is the best. Our studio, you're looking at it right here. That's M Fine. We got Jeff. He comes in on Fridays for pizza now.
Yep.
They're really good to us.
They're awesome. They'll do you right. Like M Fine, for those that don't know, it's a huge, massive, again, refurbished wood, extracted wood, building membranes. It's more on the kind of structural end than Builded Green is. Builded Green's like plumbing stuff and electrical stuff. This is strictly lumber, and it's friggin' it's things that have been like Civil War era beams that are coming out of like old crazy lofts.
I mean,
and you can get it for cheap, and they're really good guys.
Take like an old slab of wood and you will make the most beautiful table and benches that if you go to some antique store, you are going to pay thousands of dollars for.
People will shell out way more money for those sorts of things than
go
they
buy
to.
A big slab, learn how to drill it in yourself. Yep. And you've got yourself the most like beautiful antique-ish or
to tie in
refurbished.
To tie in the third plug that Trees Not Trash, we were given a sum of money by the city, or actually by citizens, and they gave us some money to do garden boxes and planters on all the trees out here on Bogart. So we were able to go to M Fine Lumber. We were able to go to BIG. We got a bunch of just huge chunks of lumber. We invested in a bunch of some tools and some screws and washers and so forth. And we were able to build these nice little seats that many people are using them right now. Well, maybe not in the rain, but
the one sitting next to me right here, Mr. Lorenzo, he smokes cigarettes out there probably once a week or once a show.
Once a minute. Actually.
It's nice to know that they're being used.
They definitely are, and they add so much to the aesthetic of the block. And you know, this place right around where we are broadcasting from right now is only continuing to grow every day. And you know,
well, we were finishing our last bench on one of the open Bushwick Art Studios things, and there were people sitting on our benches like before they were even screwed in. We were
like, wait, hold up.
You're gonna flip over into the foliage, be careful.
And they're like, oh, it's okay, I won't feel it anyway.
That's right.
No, very cool.
Well, we want to thank you for joining us, Matt. We have to wrap up the show now. Mm-hmm. Actually, we're a little over time.
Mm-hmm.
So we want all our listeners to check this out on the archives at www.heritageradionetwork.com/archives. We want to thank our sponsor, Paradise Locker Meats, keeping it real in Trimble.
We want to keep those call-ins coming, so feel free to call us anytime, Friday at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time at 718-497-2128. And Mr. Matt Lorenz, we would love to have you on again, maybe you know, in the next season to talk about, you know, what new things are happening, because it seems like you've got something new every
day.
That
sounds great. We've got a program with the Bushwick Public Library I mentioned that we're really excited about, so I'll have to give you a little report on how that's going.
An update on that. That sounds like a great project. So,
and a shout out to our engineer, Nat Wiener.
Yep.
Everybody's talking at me. I don't hear words they're saying. Only the echoes.